Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, and podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. Later in the program, Robert Knott will be speaking of the arts with us. Right now, I would like to welcome cultural historian Lois Rudnick. She is a professor emerita, which I have just learned is the female of emeritus, meaning retired professor, of American Studies at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. And she has recently moved to New Mexico, and she's the author of a new book, Katie Wells and Southwestern Modernism, published by the Museum of New Mexico Press. And she will be speaking tonight, November 13th at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore and doing a book signing about the new book. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.
So Katie Wells, C-A-D-Y, yes. Not Katie, not a girl.
Which everybody assumes whenever I say his name to someone who's never heard of him.
Right. Tell us who he was. He was an artist who, I have to say, was new to me.
Katie Wells is probably well-known by people who are interested in modern art of New Mexico, and you can see some of his works in some of the galleries in Santa Fe and in some of the museums. But this is the first book ever to have been written about him. And what caught my attention was when I first saw his paintings. I discovered him through Mabel Dodge Lujan, as I've discovered many of the other folks I've written about. I was mesmerized by how dark and powerful and emotional and unland of enchantment-like his paintings were. And for years, I've been looking at his paintings for over 20 years. I wondered, who was he? Why did he paint like this? No one who comes to this state would ever look at the landscape, which is what he mostly painted, and see the darkness, the brooding, the kind of large, writhing, organic figures that he painted, semi-abstract, sort of surrealistic at times. And I discovered that, aside from a master's thesis that had been written about him in 1968 and a few paragraphs in some of the art histories, he was sort of an unwritten-about figure. So I was having a sabbatical come up, and I thought, what if I applied to the O'Keeffe Foundation and Research Foundation and did some work on Katie Wells? I did. I got a fellowship and had the good fortune of discovering thousands of pages of papers that his brother had left to the Archives of American Art, and learned that he was from Massachusetts, from a very wealthy family, that he was born in Southbridge and brought up to sort of be part of the family business, the American Optical Company, but he was a rebel from the time he was a young boy. He dropped out or got kicked out of 5 boarding schools. His father ended up sending him to a ranch school in Arizona, hoping to kind of straighten him out.
And literally straighten him out
because he was gay, and as was his younger brother, Mason, who is the one responsible for preserving these papers and for making sure that Wells didn't just disappear off the face of the earth when he died in 1954, 10 days before his 50th birthday. And it took him a long time to figure out who he was. He was trained as a concert pianist. He wanted to paint. His family was not really interested in having him go into either of those professions. His father's sort of last attempt to help him become a more masculine, traditional kind of guy was to send him to a psychiatrist who told him to stop reading literature and don't listen to music and make sure you're never alone with a group of boys, with one or two boys. And he eventually, after lots of struggles, going to New York, studying with some famous theater designers, took a trip to the Far East, to Japan and China and Bali, came back through New Mexico in 1931, met E. Boyd Van Cleve, who invited him to stay with her. And in 1932, he began to study with Andrew Dasburg. He had had no formal training as a painter. Dasburg told him to come back when he was serious. A year later, he went back to Cambridge, took some courses at the Fogg Art Museum, came back in 1933, and decided painting was his life. In fact, that very year, after he'd only been painting really for 3 months, he wrote to Alfred Stieglitz and asked him to look at his work and said, I don't know who you are, but our mutual friend Marie Garland, who was kind of a grande dame, who had a magnificent hacienda in just north of Santa Fe, told me I should write to you, and Stieglitz was just, you know, who do you think you are, young man? But what a lot of chutzpah he had. And he said, I've spent my life trying to justify who I am to myself and my family. I've just started to paint. I know that this is the passion of my life, and I'm going to be a painter forever. And just a couple of years later, bought a home in Hakona in the Pauaki Valley, and sort of the 15-mile perimeter around there became his subject matter for his work. He started out a lot like John Marin and Andrew Dasburg, painting bright, vibrant, musical watercolors, and that's what he was a watercolorist. It was his chosen medium. But by the mid-1930s, late 1930s, he's moving into much darker, more surrealistic and fantastical kinds of paintings of the landscape. One of his friends, who became his chief promoter, Merle Armitage, wrote of him, and several other people said this, including his friend Martha Graham, who became very close to him in the post-World War II era, that he was the only artist who ever got under the skin of New Mexico.
That's something that you write about in this book. You edit the book, and you have pieces in it, and other people write in this book
yes.
as well. Katie Wells and Southwestern Modernism, by the way, is the title of the book. That there was an interesting relationship between the artists and writers and cultural community that came to New Mexico from elsewhere. They, on one level, kind of ignored the poverty and the reality of what was going on here among the local people, the Hispanic and Indian people, and so on. And on the other hand, they kind of elevated the beauty of their arts and crafts.
Right.
What did Katie Wells, what was his relationship like to that?
Katie was both a part of that and not a part of it. He was, if you look at his art, there is no way that one could say that he is blind to the sense of violence and tragedy that is endemic to the history of New Mexico, both in terms of what happened in geologic time, because he was fascinated by the volcanic eruptions that had shaped the landscape, as well as with the Penitente Brotherhood, whom he painted and whose crosses he painted throughout much of his career. And while many of the Anglos who became interested in the Penitentes, not all of them, were fascinated by the exoticism of some of the ritual practices during Easter week, when self-flagellation is part of the celebration of the coming of the crucifixion of Jesus, I think his interest and fascination had much more to do with the sense of the Penitentes as practicing a form of spirituality that incorporated everything he loved: theater, drama, a sense of the utter tragedy of humankind and our mortality, a deep sense of our mortality, and the need for penance, which is something Katie felt that he needed to do for much of his life. He never quite felt he lived up to what his family's expectations were, even though once he became a noted artist on the national scene, his family was very proud of him. I think he always struggled with issues of sexual identity, and I found this in some of his diary entries, where he was clearly very ambivalent about being typed as a homosexual, as a quote-unquote sissy or fairy, which were common terminologies in the 19-teens and 1920s. And even though he had at least three lovers over a long term that I know of while he was living there, this is something he struggled with, I think, for much of his life, and is part of, though certainly not all of, what his dark and tragic art is about. But he was also, as Robin Gavin says in her wonderful essay on his Santos, using the Santos or drawing upon them for very different reasons, for his own reasons. If you look at those beautiful bultos that are the subject matter of many of his paintings, there's nothing tragic in their expressions. They're serene and they're calm. And Katie gives to them an emotional darkness that is very different from their original intention. So one could say that, like other Anglo artists, he appropriated indigenous art forms for his own needs and his own purposes. He also was extraordinarily philanthropic and generous. According to his brother's partner, whom I interviewed, when he was collecting the Santos, he promised the people of Española Valley that they would not leave the state. He funded milk for the children in the valley. He helped to found, after the war, the Maternal and Infant Health Center that helped poor women and children who were living in the northern New Mexico area, giving them physical help. And I found out from one woman I talked to, dental help as well, medical as well as dental help. So he was very much aware of the poverty that was an endemic part of this region, especially beginning in the early 20th century. But like many of the other Anglo artists, he lived, and socialized with people who were artists and writers and folks who were coming from all over the country, who were here to come and see New Mexico and found its landscape and its indigenous peoples fascinating and compelling, for good and not so good reasons.
We're talking to Lois Rudnick about Katie Wells and Southwestern Modernism. That's the name of her new book. She'll be at Collected Works Bookstore tonight at 6 in the evening. His house was beautiful. There's some illustrations of it, and was, I don't know whether you or somebody else writes about this, but as much a work of art as his other art, as much of an expression of him. And he seemed like just such a lovely person, kind to friends, mm-hmm. to strangers, even to animals, and just surrounding himself with beauty, even while he had all this darkness inside
himself. I know. It's very interesting, because in terms of his personality, he was, didn't know him, obviously, but he is described as being absolutely hilarious, very, very witty, had a wonderful sense of mimicry. He could imitate anyone. He played practical jokes on his friends. He was generous, kind, and loving. I have to say, he is the only artist, writer, I've written about in all the 30 years I've been writing about northern New Mexico's Anglo communities, art and writers communities, who no one ever had a single negative thing to say about that I interviewed who knew him. Just generous, kind, loving, and giving, and a wonderful, incredible friend.
Now, one of the influences on his work was Los Alamos and World War II.
Mm-hmm. I think his art becomes most powerful when he comes back from 9 months of serving in the European theater in France and Germany, where he sees many of the final battles of World War II, visits the death camps, and is, for the first time in his life, I would say, seriously politicized, horrified by the tragedy of 50 million people dying, horrified about what he saw as the military's misuse of young men, sending too many young men off as cannon fodder in the last months of the battle in order to end it all. And he came back from the war. He'd gone to war feeling that it was his patriotic duty, as a person whose life had been transformed by New Mexico, to give back to his state and his country. And he came back incredibly disillusioned and really traumatized by his experiences. He lived 12 miles from Los Alamos, and there were continual explosions going off on the plateau. He did not know, no one did, once the lab became closed after the war was over, to anybody, any civilians, really what was going on there. And he was convinced that Los Alamos was ground zero, that, that where he was living was going to help, was going to be the place where the first targets would be in the next world war. And his painting was deeply influenced both by the war experiences and by Los Alamos. Some of those later paintings he did in 46, 47, and 48 are speaking directly to a post-atomic world. There's one that you may have seen, Mary Charlotte, called Paleozoic Era, where he has a penitente cross exploding off the top of the mountains with arms trying to embrace it, as though saying, maybe this was once the land of enchantment, but as he wrote to his dealer, there is no place to escape to anymore.
Why has his work not been written about before. I mean, it must be wonderful for you as an art historian, a cultural historian, to find fresh material. It's not like writing about Georgia O'Keeffe, who's been written about 5 gazillion times.
Though I did find fabulous letters between him and O'Keeffe that no one had ever read before or used before, which were wonderful. And finding all these letters from Martha Graham was an extraordinary experience. I don't really know why he has not been written about before. The last long publication was Kate Duncan's thesis, which wasn't published in 1967. She wrote that. And most people who've written about him have sort of worked off that dissertation. I don't really know why. The materials are there. I didn't know that till I looked. I think part of it may be that he doesn't fit into any of the traditional categories by which we understand modern artists in New Mexico, while there are other artists after the war who are painting disturbing paintings and making disturbing prints related to their sense of this post-atomic world. Nobody was doing really 15 years of dark, brooding, highly emotional paintings that don't fit into the light, you know, celebration of New Mexico sunshine and land of enchantment world. And I think that he's hard to categorize.
So it is a little disturbing that ability to be categorized would influence your being written about if you're a good artist.
I don't know if that was it. I'm guessing. I think also, this is true that watercolor does not have the value, the kind of imprimatur that oil does. And though he worked in mixed media after the war, and though he tried oils because Georgia O'Keeffe told him he had to, though he was very unsuccessful at it, he really loved the medium of watercolor. He loved the fact that you had to be, that it requires you to be both decisive, because you make a mistake, you can't fix it the way you can cover oil painting, and spontaneous. So he loved both the discipline and the freedom of watercolor. But it's valued as a secondary medium. If you look at his paintings...
And it's valued that way on the art market.
On the art market, absolutely. And if you look at his... the few people I've talked to so far who've looked at his work, or the people who know his work, many of them look at his work and say, I can't believe this is watercolor. Raymond Johnson wrote to his father after he died that he thought he was the best watercolorist of the first part of the 20th century. And I, of course, agree, but I have a certain bias since I love his work so much.
So you've written this book, which is published by the Museum of New Mexico Press. There's going to be an exhibition, although not really soon.
No, it's going to open at the end of January at the University of New Mexico Museum of Art and at Aaron Payne Fine Arts in Santa Fe.
We're talking January 2011.
January 2011.
And the images that are in this book will be shown?
Many of them, not all of them. Some are very expensive to bring into the museum. And one of the things I was after when I wrote the book was to make sure to get the best images I could find in museums and private collections throughout the country, so that at least they would be there in the book. But the museum exhibit will be a wonderful representation of his art, and Aaron Payne's will be another wonderful one, a smaller version, since his gallery is smaller.
Are his paintings owned by and large by museums or by collectors or both?
Both. His brother donated many of his works of art to museums all over the country. He's in the Smithsonian, he's in the Whitney, Santa Barbara Museum, Colorado Springs Museum, so really all over the country. And then many private collections. In fact, there are probably a good 100 paintings I haven't discovered yet because they're owned by people I couldn't find.
So he died young.
Yes, 10 days before his 50th birthday in November of 1954.
How did he die?
Heart attack. He'd had one a few months before. And one of the most poignant stories I heard from one of his close friends, Frank Hamilton, was that he had a premonition from the time he came back from the war that something terrible was going to happen to him. And I think that was part of what we would call post-traumatic stress disorder. But in the last few months after his first heart attack, Frank Hamilton told me he played all the death scenes from his favorite operas.
Wow.
As though he knew.
There are premonitions.
Yes,
I mean,
there are.
I'm as much of a science person as the next person, but I mean, that's very interesting.
It is. It's very interesting and inexplicable, actually. But I think he had a sense that he was going to die young, way before his time.
So he is part of Southwestern modernism. That's a term that, if you look at it sideways, seems almost like an oxymoron.
Say why. That's very interesting. I had never thought of it as an oxymoron. But there are many modern painters who started coming out here. Many of them, the first one was Andrew Dasburg. He's sort of considered to be the father of Southwest modernism. And he came out when Mabel said, hurry up and get out to Taos because you're going to love it here, which he did. I mean, he went back and forth to New York, but he lived much of the rest of his life in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and beyond in both Taos and Santa Fe. So there were modern painters who came out here and who worked out here, like Dasburg, like Marin. Marston Hartley was one of the early ones, like Georgia O'Keeffe. And when in the early days, when Mabel first came to Taos, there was a real tension between the Taos School of Artists, who did these traditional sort of impressionist landscapes and romanticized views of Indians and the Pueblo, and those who are working in a more modern medium, who are, you know, more interested in fracturing of form and of sort of what the process of making art rather than copying something that was already there. So there is a strong tradition in both Santa Fe and Taos of what we would call modern art, many different styles and types of modern art.
Katie Wells grew up in New England, where his father tried to cure him of being gay and had to go through this long process, as you were talking about before. Was he finally, do you think, able to really be himself and be peaceful in the environment of northern New Mexico?
I don't think Katie Wells was ever peaceful. I think that was just contrary to his personality and his nature. He was very, very restless. He left New Mexico for a while. After the war, he had serious bursitis. He built a house in St. Croix. He was always traveling to Chicago, New York, to visiting his family in Palm Springs. So he was just a restless, seeking spirit who I don't know if he was ever at peace. Though the last 2 years of his paintings, after he discovered Chartres Cathedral in France, and he tried to get the luminosity of stained glass on paper, his work seems much more at peace and much calmer than the work that he did up until 1952. So he may indeed have come to a point where he was at peace with himself. Certainly by 1952, he had stopped thinking of selling his home, which he had thought about a lot after he came back from the war.
Lois Rudnick is a cultural historian and author of the new book, Katie Wells and Southwestern Modernism, published by the Museum of New Mexico Press. And once again, she will be at Collected Works Bookstore tonight at 6 o'clock here in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us.
A great pleasure. Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And I'm certainly looking forward to seeing these things because, of course, watercolors, no matter how beautifully you reproduce them, and this is a very, very beautiful book. The book is itself a nice work of art and design.
Mm-hmm.
You still can't really see what they're like until you see them in
exactly.
The flesh. Well, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break right now, and we'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. And Robert Knott will be with us in just a moment, but right now I would like to welcome Sarah Pierpont, who is with the Recycle Santa Fe Art Festival, and Nancy Woodward, who is the director of the Dragonfly School, whose little kitties are participating in recycling. Welcome, ladies.
Hey, welcome.
Be here.
So the Recycle Santa Fe Art Festival, it's tonight and over the weekend. Recycling and art. So what kind of art are we talking about?
Well, it's really interesting and it's really unique. It's basically taking trash into treasure. All of the art at the festival consists of at least 75% recycled material. So that means you have a sculpture that when you look a little more closely, you realize it's bottle caps and scrap metal and weird things that you wouldn't expect to find in art. But the culmination is really beautiful. And there's a wide range of pieces, from jewelry to sculpture to paintings to a little bit of everything.
And there's also always a recycled fashion show.
That's
is that
right.
happening too?
Yes, it is. It's happening tonight, and it's always a lot of fun. The weekend kicks off tonight with the fashion show at 7 p.m., and it's really the best of what we like to call trash chic. And it's just beautiful fashion made out of garbage.
Now, the Dragonfly School is populated by children from ages, what, 3 to 10, 3 to 8?
3 to 8 this year.
And what is your participation in this whole recycling?
Well, we have a theme that works around recycling. So we clean the river once a month and bring up anything we find that can be recycled, as well as all the garbage, which we collect in different bins. And the kids are looking at them grow as the year goes by, and they're weighing them. But we've been harvesting some things from the River Recycling Project, as well as having kids bring things from their home to make recycled art, because we've been working on this for a couple months. So the littlest dragonflies are using things like oatmeal cartons or the bins that chickens come in from the grocery store, Pringles cans, lids to things to make vehicles. And we have very large vehicles and very tiny vehicles. Some of which have very elaborate wheels, many of which are decorated with things like bits of crayon that are glued on, or lids to markers, which are very colorful, lids to cans. Our older kids have made a rug using pieces of their cast-off clothing on a large floor loom, so that...
It's like the Rag Rug Festival.
Yeah, and it's got nylon stockings and plastic bags and other colorful objects that might not make it into a traditional rag rug. And we also have a great collection of creatures that one of our teachers had a ton of bins that dog biscuits come in. And so we have this set of creatures that they've all made using one of these bins that look like what I think of as a Hershey cocoa container.
Right.
As the base, with legs and things stuck on to make heads and tails and fur and, you know, all kinds of things.
There's a lot of opportunities for education of children. I mean, you're learning about river ecology and recycling and the nature of materials and art and all sorts of things.
Yeah, and I think it really opens up a different place for kids to be creative when they use something that they found and make it into something else. You know, there's this sort of thing you see in your imagination and make on paper, but then you have these objects and you start moving them around and turning them into a sculpture or a 3D object. And there's a real playfulness that comes out with that.
So all of this is happening in El Museo Cultural starting this evening and going through the weekend. You also, Sarah Pierpont, are part of a larger recycling effort in the city.
In the state, I'm the deputy director of the New Mexico Recycling Coalition, and that's a statewide nonprofit that is working to increase recycling rates throughout the state.
How's that going?
Where our recycling rate is up 1.4%, so we're at 12.4% statewide, which is not as high as the national average of 33%, but we're getting there slowly. So recycling is improving throughout New Mexico.
Why are we so much lower than everybody else?
Everyone asks that. It's a hard question. You know, 20 years ago, New Mexico still had rural dump sites where people could just take their trash and dump it at the end of the arroyo, and that was the official place to take your trash. So we had to get ahead of the curve by just getting our dumps lined and getting them to, the landfill. And so we've worked on that, and we have officially lined dumps now. Now we need to work on getting them recycling better.
So the Recycle Santa Fe Art Festival is tonight, tomorrow, and Sunday at El Museo Cultural. For more information, people can go to recyclesantafe.org. And is there a number that they can call?
They can call my number, which is 603-0558.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Sarah Pierpont and Nancy Woodward, Dragonfly School and Recycle Santa Fe Art Festival. We'll see you tonight.
Thanks.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
Robert Knott will be with us in just a moment. Please stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome Robert Knott. He is the associate editor of the Pasatiempo, Friday Arts Magazine in the Santa Fe New Mexican. And he is with us just about every Friday speaking of the arts. Welcome, Robert.
Good morning. How is you?
I am fine. And you are also the Education Beat reporter.
I'm working on it. I'm stumbling through it, trying to do as much as I can. So it's all good. It's all exciting.
It's all good, she said.
I heard Dean Martin sing a song that didn't fit him, but it's a great song.
So, what's happening this weekend besides the Recycle Santa Fe Art Show and besides Lois Rudnick, who's going to be at Collected Works tonight?
Well, Roz Chast, you know who she is?
Yes.
Yeah, she's going to be there tonight.
At the?
Gerald Peters Gallery. Jonathan Richards, a freelancer for Pasatiempo, did a terrific profile of her. He is a superb cartoonist himself. And it's a great, great, great story about a great artist, great images in the Pasatiempo today. She has just this terrific, absurd sense of humor. It's almost like the Monty Python of cartoonists, but I don't know if she would appreciate me saying that. But I'm going to go tonight. It will be at Gerald Peters. The reception is 5 to 7. They are at 1011 Paseo de Peralta. The exhibit is through mid-December. Take a look at the cover story of Pasatiempo and head on over there. I'm going to be there.
So tonight at Santa Fe Complex, No Balance, fifth death-iversary tribute to Coil's John Balance. And he was a singer, songwriter, and co-founder of the influential musical group called Coil. And 13 local acts will be memorializing John by covering his work and ideals through music, film, and collaboration. I got an email about it that said, don't bring kids, kind of adult themes. It's not 18 and over, but you may not want to bring your smaller children.
I suspect that's true. The Santa Fe Film Festival has a huge ad in the Paso Tiempo today, a couple of weeks in advance, but we are going to be covering that in Paso.
And on this show.
If you're interested, yeah, I'm sure. You and me often talk about, in fact, we usually spend that Friday talking about the Santa Fe Film Festival options. That would be December 4th.
Yeah, well, I usually devote, and I probably will do so this year as well, the entire week of the film festival to nothing but directors and actors and so on.
Yeah, so this is interesting. There's going to be a lot of documentaries and some weird avant-garde stuff. And anyway, if you're curious what it's about right now, take a look at their ad in Paso Tiempo, and it starts on December 2nd. Frank Buffalo Hyde. He's currently working up in Long Island. He's Iroquois, and he has got a show at the Wheelwright Museum of the American Indian, 704 Camino Alejo, up on Museum Hill. Opens with a reception tomorrow, 5 to 7 p.m. Exhibit runs through April 4th. Take a look at Doug Fairfield's story in today's Paso Tiempo. Really, really nice work. And you know what? You and I do this a lot, and I feel bad if we're preaching to the choir, but I just like to do it every few weeks. Press releases, keep them short, keep them simple, get all the data on there. I know last week you had one without a day or something. The day, the date, they should be connected. They should correlate.
Who, what, when, where, exactly. Day, date, event, phone number, website, no attachments. Thank you very much.
Ditto. And in Paso Tiempo's case, we want the price. I know we don't mention prices on KSFR.
Right.
But if it's pay what you wish or free, obviously, let us know. Tell us, because honestly, we still get press releases that are incomplete, and if you can't afford a PR person, which is totally understandable, just go over the stuff really simply yourself.
Tonight, Hale Esfandiari. She is a woman who wrote a book called My Prison, My Home, One Woman's Story of Captivity in Iran.
Wow.
And it's a wonderful book. We had her on the air just the other day, and she is she works at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Princeton, and she founded the Middle East program there, and is a wonderful scholar and journalist, and she was a female activist in Iran, and she went back to visit her elderly mother, and they basically arrested her and put her in prison for trying to overthrow the United States. It was just completely like conspiracy theory madness, and she wrote this beautiful and very interesting memoir about it. Anyway, she's going to be on here in Santa Fe tonight at 5:30 at the Unitarian Church.
Great.
Santa Fe Council on International Relations.
Entertainment of a different sort this weekend up at Lodge of Santa Fe as Artemis. Wonderful guy, terrific performer, drag queen, will be performing his final show in Santa Fe at, according to Paso Tiempo, 8:30 p.m. Friday and Saturday, the 13th and the 14th. You got to pay to get in. Here's a phone number. 795-1187 if you want to see him off. I've seen a couple of his shows. He's often played the Rainbow Vision. But there he is at the Lodge of Santa Fe, 750 North St. Francis Drive.
Yay.
Tonight and Saturday. Meanwhile, Chaim Mayhem is going to celebrate Max Friedenberg's birthday. He founded it, or co-founded it. He used to work at Warehouse 21, did my first theater show there with Max. His father's responsible for getting my job at the New Mexican, so when I get my hands on him, I'll ... 9 o'clock Thursday, Chaim Mayhem's new space at 2811 Siler Lane. There's going to be a 9 o'clock triple bill concert, including by the Zex Marquet, Free Moral Agents, and We Drew Lightning. There is a requested donation. 9 o'clock Thursday. Take a look and see. Meanwhile, Serenade of Santa Fe. Serenade of Santa Fe is a favorite of mine. 3 o'clock Sunday. They're going to have, and you know what? Honestly, I never try to mispronounce names wrong, but I have trouble with it, particularly, unless it's John Smith or
especially
Robert Knott.
Especially German composers?
No, in this case, it's pianist Zeta Ruger Suzuki and violinist Hidetaro Suzuki, and I trust I pronounced them fairly well, and they're going to be performing at 3 o'clock Sunday at the Santuario de Guadalupe. You have to pay to get in, and it's 989-7988. They're going to be playing, among other things, and I can pronounce this composer's name, Mozart, and also that other guy, Brahms.
There you go.
There
They're
you
German
go.
Composers.
They
You're doing very
are.
Well, Robert.
Well, thank you very much. I'll continue. Why don't you stop patting me on the head like I'm 4 years old?
The Assassination of Fred Hampton, How the FBI and Chicago Police Murdered a Black Panther by Jeff Haas. He wrote a book and kind of a memoir on that subject. He's going to be at Garcia Street Books on, well, tomorrow, November 14th, from 5 to 6:30. And it's a terrific book, and he's a great guy. He was a lawyer for the Black Panthers and all sorts of groups along those lines in the 1960s and 70s, and continuing with civil rights law all through his career. And also Garcia Street Books, along with Wild Earth Guardians, is co-sponsoring the visit of Margaret Atwood and Graham Gibson, husband and wife, great Canadian writers, who will be in Santa Fe at the Lensic on Tuesday evening.
Correct. And plug in Paso Tiempo again. We have stories in both those literary events you just talked about. Craig Smith did a piece. Craig Smith, last week was his last week. I miss him already. And we also have a piece on the Fred Haas book, so take a look in Paso. But those are great things that you're plugging. Out of nowhere, I just started thinking about the themes of the Patty Duke Show, and I couldn't remember the lyrics. Do you?
What?
Wasn't it something like, meet Kathy, who's been most everywhere from
Zanzibar
to
Berkeley Square.
But Kathy's only seen the sights. No,
why?
Patty.
Why?
But Patty's only seen the sights a gal can see from Brooklyn Heights. What a crazy pair. But they're cousins. Identical.
Why? Why? Why are you
because
doing
I like,
this?
Maybe it's because I just saw, like, you know, this twin special that the magazine had that I sometimes subscribe to where they have twins. But why would cousins be identical twins? Is that possible in your
No,
view?
It's just it's because it's a sitcom from the 60s. Okay. Can I change the subject for just a second? Voyages of Discovery, Darwin and Mendelssohn. That
Those
is
guys.
A concert tomorrow, a concert and event tomorrow night at the Lensic at 8 o'clock, which is a collaboration between the Santa Fe Symphony Music and the Santa Fe Institute, Chaos Science, Complexity Science. And not only will they be playing music of Mendelssohn, but Kirk Ellis and Jonathan Richards.
Oh, what a pair of clowns. It's like Red Skelton and Bob Hope. And they're going to dress up.
They're going to be playing
they're
Darwin.
They're going to put on the wigs and everything.
Yeah, Darwin and Mendelssohn.
And
I'm talking
the
about
fancy
them.
Clothes.
And Darwin and Mendelssohn were born like 10 days apart in 1809.
That's so like me and you, except the date was different.
Yeah, it wasn't 1809.
No, but we were like 20 days apart and 20 miles apart.
That's right.
And apparently 20 years apart.
not quite.
No, I know. But anyway, this is going to be good. Stephen Smith will be leading the SFSO in their orchestrations. And Kirk Ellis and Jonathan Richards, not only good people, but excellent writers, both great film reviewers, actually, although Kirk's now writing screenplays. They're going to be reading excerpts from the letters. And again, you got to pay to get in. 988-1234. Student discounts available. There's also a 6 p.m. reception at the El Dorado Hotel. So check all this out. Go see it. If you like Mendelssohn, if you like Darwin. Now, did those guys hang out a lot? What do we know about them? Were they like pals? Did they play cricket together?
No, it wasn't Chase like women? That. But they both went. It's called Voyages of Discovery because they both went way far away from home and did some of their best work. I mean, Darwin obviously went to South America and looked around and got the idea about natural selection, which is kind of a big thing. But Mendelssohn also went traveling and wrote some of his best work abroad.
Well, I've written some of my best work abroad, too, and what abroad she was. Hey, listen, Hank Rogerson and Jillian Spitzmiller are married. They're also documentary filmmakers. They did an excellent documentary many of you may have seen.
Shakespeare Behind Bars.
They're amazing. I spend a lot of time behind bars, especially when I get thrown out the back door. But anyway, they're doing a discussion on documentary filmmaking getting started. It's a free talk, and I think they're going to be really helpful in terms of anyone out there trying to start or film a documentary who doesn't know what they're doing. It's free. It's in the community room of the Santa Fe Public Library downtown. These are great lectures that anybody can go to. So head on down there. It's 7 o'clock Wednesday. There's a little mixed media about this in Paso Tiempo today, page 13. You can also visit the couple's website, documentaryhowto.com. And it's particularly interesting because when we get to the Santa Fe Film Festival discussion, I think more than half the films, or at least half the films this year, are documentaries. So that's interesting.
Really?
So movie-wise, just so you know, An Education opens today at DeVargas. Somewhat controversial story about a young high school girl who falls in love with a man who's like 25 years older and he's married. Jonathan Richards gave it a great review. I haven't seen it yet. Pirate Radio opens over there. Still Walking opened at the screen. Got a great review in Paso today. For those of you that want mindless apocalyptic entertainment, 2012 opens at Regal Stadium 14 with John Cusack. sort of finding himself in these big budget horror pictures more and more.
Mindless being the operative word.
Finally, I've never seen Matthew Barney's Cremaster cycle. I've never seen any of them.
I haven't either.
And I feel bad because the CCA is showing them, but we couldn't write a blurb of any authenticity because no one on our staff had actually seen these pictures, which is unfortunate. I'm being honest. So they are running them, all five of them, over the next few days. Take a look at the CCA website. People that like these sort of things are going to probably love this stuff. So head on over there. Other movies include The Box, playing over at Stadium 14, and Disney's A Christmas Carol down at Regal Stadium 14, and The Men Who Stare at Goats, which I thought was okay, unbalanced, but okay. It's over at DeVargas. You still have Whip It with Drew Barrymore on skates at Regal North. You know, she plays a roller derby queen. I love roller derby when I grew up. I thought those gals
were
so sexy.
We have roller derby. We have roller derby in New Mexico.
I know. I go out and I watch them, and they, like, wheel around the track right in front of me. But I want to see more elbowing and punching, and they don't seem to – they probably want to do that to
Why
me,
do you want to see that? Are you violent?
No, but I like – I mean, when women, you know, decide they need to stand up for themselves, even if they're on skates, and they start, you know, getting into, shall we say, aggressive behavior, I find that very scintillating, not to mention interesting to watch. So, no, I don't want them to really hurt each other. I want it to be like professional wrestling where it looks real but isn't. But roller derby's real, right?
Yeah.
But professional wrestling is scripted?
I believe that is the case, yes.
I got to stop betting on that. No wonder I keep losing. Rhapsody in Blue. We all know Gershwin. It's famous. It was in the movie American in Paris, a great Gene Kelly musical. Santa Fe Pro Musical Chamber Orchestra. We'll be doing that as well as other stuff tonight at 7:30 at the Lenzic. The Yellow Lantern Theater Company, about whom I know very little, is going to present an original production of poetry, dance, and theater, 7 o'clock tonight, called At the Edge of the Village. At the Edge of the Village, you'll see a pot of gold. 7 o'clock, Teatro Paraguas presenting this in their space on Richards Lane. Here's a phone number, 424-1601. Craig Smith did a story today on three children's theater groups that have shows opening this weekend. The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, which is Santa Fe Performing Arts, City Different Players at Old Pecos Trail, Armory for the Arts. Beauty and the Beast by Pandemonium at Walt James A. Little. And then next week opens Rebecca Morgan's Southwest Children's production of 1001 Arabian Nights. And he did a little piece talking to these three groups about children's theater in town and et cetera, et cetera. He did not include El Dorado Children's Theater, and they do children's theater as well, and it's really good stuff. They don't have a show running this time of year. I believe they have a show opening in January, so please pay attention to them as well. But sometimes this stuff is really good, and you see some really young talent, some of whom I'm happy to say I later work with as they turn into teenagers and come over to Warehouse 21.
Nice.
It is nice, and they work with some really good people, Chris Leslie over at Pandemonium, Rebecca Morgan at Southwest, and Megan Burns, who's a terrific actress, writer, singer over at SFPA.
Hey, there's a state sale tomorrow from 9 to 3.
The state or the state?
A state.
I think the state's for sale, too.
A state sale, and some of the proceeds from that will go to the Santa Fe Animal Shelter. So we always are
interested
in animal welfare. But they've got things like vintage toasters and
do they work?
Lucite handbags and things like that.
That sounds great.
And it's at the Española and Santa Fe Animal Shelters will benefit from it, and it's at 63 Heartstone Drive in Santa Fe. The number 982-6877. It's from 9 to 3. Do not arrive early. Thank you very much.
21 again is Warehouse 21 hosting an open house celebration and fundraiser. Performance by Wise Fool New Mexico, Santa Fe Prep Jazz Band, Eastern Women's Ensemble, The Seventh Wave, Community Choir, and others, DJs, food, 6 o'clock Saturday. Entertainment at 8 o'clock. I got to go by and see them because I love Warehouse 21. I volunteer for them. Just understand that in case everybody wants full disclosure here. I don't take any money from them, but I do volunteer. I love Warehouse 21. 989-4423. Check out warehouse21.org. This is going to be tomorrow night, Saturday night. So Warehouse 21 is worth a visit. Go support them. It's not too much to get in, and in fact, under 13 is free. So go give them some money.
Another event, walking tour of Cerrillos Hills State Park with guide Keena Murphy from Earthworks Institute and Sarah Wood, park manager, is happening tomorrow from 10 to noon. For more information, you can call 982-9806 and find out more about this walking tour where you can learn all sorts of things about the natural world in which we live.
Let's say you want to write your memoirs, but you're not sure how to start. Lisa Dale Norton.
I was born a poor, beleaguered,
you've got to jump ahead and grab people. I mean, this is something I learned
in Newburgh,
the theater.
New York.
You've got to grab people right away. You have to start with something like, as she began to disrobe, she made me realize that my youth was misspent. Then you get people's interest.
You get your interest.
Well, that's the way I'm going to start mine. Anyway, get back to this. So you always get me off topic here.
What?
The Patty Duke show.
I didn't. You started that.
I just don't know how cousins could be identical.
Well, that has nothing to do with me.
Memoir writing, using your shimmering images, see? I was telling you. To tell the story of your life, 7 o'clock Tuesday at the Southside branch of the Santa Fe Public Library on Jaguar Drive. It's free. That's going to be Lisa Dale Norton. It's at 7 o'clock Tuesday. If you're interested in writing your memoir, head on down there.
Oh, she's terrific.
Yeah, she is. And
she
I'm going
is
to,
terrific. That's a. You know what? I just remembered. I had her on the air a while ago. That's a terrific book. There's a lot of books about writing, but that one really caught my eye. I think it's worth checking out.
I know. I'm going to be writing my own memoir soon, which are quite erotic, if I do say so myself.
Hey, check this out.
And
today, exhibition and opening of the... exhibition opening, Memory, Shadow, and Light from 5 to 7 at the Santa Fe Art Institute.
Whoa,
did
that's
you know
right.
that there's an exhibition opening there?
Did you know that the Santa Fe Art Institute is really good at publicity? They're very good at getting us the information. I'm sorry to go back to this thing.
Yeah.
And it's on time, and they're always polite, and they're professional, and they say thank you, and every detail is correct. They do a great job. And that is, honestly, quite often why we list them on the show, because they're continually...
Michelle LaFleur.
Yeah, she's terrific. You were mentioning Darwin and that other guy before.
Mendelssohn.
But we didn't say that there's also a discussion called Evolving the Genius, the Extraordinary Life of Charles Darwin on Thursday, did we?
Thursday, next Thursday? No.
At 2 o'clock, Doug Schwartz is doing this discussion at St. John's United Methodist Church on 1200 Old Pecos Trail. You got to pay to get in. But if you're a Darwin fan, Darwinism is always something that's fun to talk about, particularly if you're a chimp. It's 2 o'clock on Thursday, and it's over there at the United Methodist Church. A beautiful woman just sat down next to me. I might get distracted here. She is gorgeous. Occasionally we have visitors, and she's probably not going to speak.
No, she's not going to speak unless she wants
hot.
To. She's my mother.
She's beautiful. She's hitting me now.
She's tickling me now.
Stop.
What I didn't say about Memory, Shadow, and Light, which is the exhibition at the Santa Fe Art Institute, is that it's the people in it are photographer Gabe Block, realist painter Rackstraw Downs, photographer David Maisel, draftsman and sculptor James Drake, blacksmith Tom Joyce, sculptor Susan York, photographer Susan Micellas, I'm not sure how you say it, and filmmaker Godfrey Reggio. It's an all-star lineup.
Great. Hey, take a look at Rob DeWalt's music column, Soundways, which is, it's always hip. It's pretty cool. I'm using old terms, but Rob's a good writer, and he's put together a really good weekly account of what's happening musically. And one of the things he pitches, 7 o'clock Friday night at Santa Fe Complex. You already talked about this, No Balance, my apologies. He also talks about Round Mountain Saturday night at 8 at the Scottish Rite Temple, celebrating the release of its third CD, Windward. So take a look at Soundwaves.
And also, just to keep people up to date with what Meow Wolf is doing,
Meow.
There's a show called Geodecadent at the Meow Wolf Studio on 1800 2nd Street. It's open Fridays and Saturdays from 5 to 9 in the evening. And I think tomorrow, it may run one more weekend, but it's going to be closing soon. So
check
it out.
Well, it's time to go. You guys have been great. I want to thank you for tuning in on the Mary Charlotte Show, KSFR 101.1. You can reach her on the web at ksfr.something or other. Just look up Mary
KSFR.org.
You can also find her on a website where she's posing provocatively with a very intellectual look upon her face. And,
there's
other things you got to thank people for tuning in. Thank the people in the studio. Thank Robert Knott for being here. What a guy. What an incredibly handsome combo of Robert Mitchum and Antonio Banderas. And, Mary Charlotte, I'm going to miss you until next Friday. But I'll be back and better than ever.
Well, I didn't have to say anything, did I?
You didn't.
Robert Knott is the associate editor of the Friday of the Pasa Tiempo, which is the Friday arts magazine in the Santa Fe, New Mexico. He's with us singing and speaking of the arts every. He's singing with us singing of the arts every Friday, pretty much. And my podcast site, which he made the ridiculous reference to a moment ago, is SantaFeRadioCafe.org. And just yesterday, somebody said, what's a podcast site? It's just a website where you go, and when you click listen or download.
It's a podcast.
Well, people don't know what a podcast is.
Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the pods came to life and people
Why they get scared of it, but it just means that you can listen to the show.
Identical cousins, that couldn't happen. Meet Kathy, who's been most everywhere.
What if they were the children of their mother and their father were identical twins, who both twins married both twins?
Was that the backstory to this show?
No, but I'm just saying.
I have to go back and look at some of those reruns.
The chances that they would be identical are virtually nil, but it's not completely out of the question.
I didn't like him as much as Barbara Eden on I Dream of Jeannie.
All right, time to go. Have a wonderful weekend.
Three wishes.
Way too much to do, but
have her out of that outfit in one wish.
Have a great weekend, Robert. I'll see you later.
Bye.
Ciao.